The novelist Tracy Chevalier has made a career of bringing history to life. She's written books set in medieval France, in 18th century London, and in 17th century Holland, specifically in the home of painter Johannes Vermeer. That book tells the story of a Dutch teenager who became a maid in the Vermeer household, and the subject, as Chevalier imagines it, of one of his most famous works, Girl with a Pearl Earring. Well, Tracy Chevalier is back with a new historical novel. It's called Remarkable Creatures, and at its center is a pioneering 19th century fossil hunter named Mary Anning. Chevalier encountered Mary Anning's story one day while visiting a small dinosaur museum in England.
I had never heard of her, and I learned from the display that she was a working-class girl who had lived in Lyme Regis, which is on the south coast of England, and had been fossil hunting with her father. And one day she and her brother discovered a huge specimen of what turned out to be an ichthyosaur, an ancient marine reptile about 200 million years old. Had no idea what it was, thought it was a crocodile, and went on to discover another ancient marine reptile called a plesiosaur. And she was really quite an amazing woman because she was completely self-taught, never had any formal education, was very poor, found these things for a living. And maybe most importantly to me as a novelist, she was struck by lightning as a baby and she survived it and to live to tell the tale. And I loved that. When I found this out, I thought, I have got to write a novel and I've got to start it off with a lightning strike.
And you open the book with the line, "Lightning has struck me all my life, just once it was real." I wonder if you would read a bit of that passage for us.
Sure. "The lightning killed the woman holding me and two girls standing next to her, but I survived. They say I was a quiet, sickly child before the storm, but after it I grew up lively and alert. I cannot say if they're right, but the memory of that lightning still runs through me like a shiver. It marks powerful moments of my life, seeing the first crocodile skull Joe found and finding its body myself, discovering other monsters on the beach, meeting Colonel Birch. Other times, I'll feel the lightning strike and wonder why it's come. Sometimes I don't understand, but accept what the lightning tells me, for the lightning is me. It entered me when I was a baby and never left. I feel an echo of the lightning each time I find a fossil, a little jolt that says, 'Yes, Mary Anning, you are different from all the rocks on the beach. That is why I'm a hunter, to feel that bolt of lightning and that difference every day.'"
So that's the first chapter of your book, the way you open it. And again, this was real person, Mary Anning, who really did survive a lightning bolt. And to be clear, this is a book set in the very first part of the 19th century, the early 1800s.
Yes.
This is, a couple of generations before Darwin was writing Origin of Species. And what she was finding, you know, the scientists were still really trying to understand the very concept of what a fossil was.
That's right. It was prime Jane Austen territory, if you like. It was early 19th century. Most people believed that the world was 6,000 years old and it had been created by God in 6 days and set to run and was exactly, if you looked around, it was exactly as God had made it. They took the Bible as literal history. And their scientists were very slowly starting to question that. And when Mary discovered this specimen of an animal that clearly didn't exist now, first they called it a crocodile, but they really quickly realized it couldn't be because it has this huge bulbous eye like a donut, and it has paddles rather than claws and legs. And they quickly figured out it was an animal that was extinct, and that was like setting off a little bomb and this cozy idea that the world was 6,000 years old, because suddenly people realized, actually, the world isn't just as God had made it. There are animals that have died out that have gone extinct, and that was a very new concept.
So Mary Anning, as she hunts for fossils on the beach, you write about how she would look at these things and she felt a sense of wonder and of awe at what she was seeing, but she didn't really understand it. The other narrator for your book and the other central character is a woman named Elizabeth Philpott, and she did understand it a bit more. Tell us about her.
Well, Elizabeth was like a little gift to me as a novelist. When I started researching about Mary's life, I kept hearing about this woman named Elizabeth Philpott, who became a very good friend of Mary's, and they used to go out fossil hunting on the beach every day. And Elizabeth was 20 years older than Mary, a middle-class woman who had moved with two sisters down to Lyme Regis from London in 1805. And they never married, and they became quite interested in fossils. But I thought Elizabeth was perfect because when I was looking into Mary's life, I thought it's going to be very difficult to tell this story only from Mary's point of view because her point of view is necessarily limited because her experience is limited. She hardly ever left Lyme Regis and she never had any formal education. And so I needed a voice. I needed somebody who could, in a way, be the reader, standing, watching the person who's the genius at work and commenting and thinking about them. So it's a book that becomes about more about their developing relationship. It's about fossils, but it's also about friendship. And in a way, this book tries to answer that question, what do women do who don't find the Mr. Darcy of the Jane Austen novels? What do they do when they don't get married? What is there for them in this society that expects them to marry?
Mary Anning, not someone that most people will have heard of today, certainly not before reading your novel. She did leave one legacy, though, that lasts, and that's something that may be familiar to children, a saying that you discovered, was based on her.
There is a tongue twister. She sells seashells by the seashore. And I think that was created in 1908, supposedly as a tribute to Mary Anning, who sold mostly fossils, but she did indeed sell seashells by the seashore. And the funny thing was, I was originally going to name the book She Sells Seashells, and then I thought, there's no way I'm going to do that because I'm going to have to say it so many times that I'll never be able to do it.
Do you feel any pressure from having had such a huge success with Girl with a Pearl Earring relatively early in your career, knowing that you're going to have a really big audience no matter what you write? A lot of people will read it.
I'll tell you what I feel pressure most is getting things right. Most people aren't going to read a biography of Mary Anning or read scientific books about her. They're going to read this novel and they're going to think that's exactly how it happened. I had that feeling after I wrote Girl with the Pearl Earring. People took it as if that was what really happened with Vermeer the painter, and that's how the painting came about, when actually I made most of it up. And I had no idea that the book was going to have the success it did. And so afterwards, it was a real shock. And ever since then, as I write books about things that really happened, I have to be very careful. So I definitely feel the pressure of being, in a way, like Mary Anning's representative, and I need to get it right as best I can.
Tracy Chevalier speaking to us about her latest novel, Remarkable Creatures. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You can read an excerpt from the book about the discovery that launched Mary Anning's career as a fossil hunter at our website, npr.org. President Obama has made some major changes in the past year to this country's Afghanistan strategy, promising to triple the number of troops there and to focus on counterinsurgency techniques. But when it comes to global AIDS policy, the president has pretty much stuck to the blueprint laid out by the Bush administration. And for some people dedicated to fighting AIDS, that's a concern. NPR's Brenda Wilson reports.
Nearly $14 billion were spent on the global AIDS epidemic in 2009, with the U.S. contributing about half of that money. That's far more than the hundreds of millions of dollars that were spent a decade ago. It means that millions of people in developing countries now get anti-AIDS drugs. But that's made U.S. Global AIDS Ambassador Eric Goosby's job harder.
We are constantly increasing the number of individuals that are alive and continuing to use services. And it is a growing, crescendo kind of economic burden that the United States and the countries are learning how to accommodate.
That strategy may have worked well getting millions of people into treatment, Goosby says, but it's neither efficient nor sustainable to continue to deal with AIDS as if it is an emergency.
One that is completely dependent on offshore resources and not embedded in the public system of the country runs the risk of being ephemeral and dependent on how steady and reliable those resources remain.
And the recent global recession has threatened both the steadiness and reliability of that kind of funding. Instead of relying on one program, such as the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, Goosby says the U.S. has a new five-year strategy that would help low- and middle-income countries build their own healthcare systems that incorporate international health programs.
Taking the PEPFAR, the TB, the malaria, the vaccine, the maternal-to-child health, family planning, reproductive health platforms, pull them together to actually really create a essential package of primary care services.
Talk like this worries AIDS advocates, who see the administration broadening the global health agenda without putting much more money in. As it now stands, only half of the people who need drugs are getting them. Christine Lubinsky of the Infectious Diseases Society of America thinks the president chose the right person for the job, but put him in an impossible position.
I happen to feel they made a very good choice, a man who's been an amazing advocate and provider of HIV treatment and now may be faced with telling all of these countries they need to do more with less. At the same time, you know, tens of thousands of very sick people are knocking on the door asking for treatment.
That's where we are now, more than 25 years into the epidemic, with no end in sight. In 2031, the epidemic will be 50. Robert Hecht, a development expert with AIDS 2031, recently did some projections on how to spend AIDS money to get the best results.
Smart prevention today, like male circumcision, or preventing the transmission from infected mothers to their babies, reaching discriminated, stigmatized groups like men having sex with men or injecting drug users in certain countries. If the money is concentrated in those kinds of areas, we can both slow down the number of new infections and can lower the costs of treatment in the future.
In fact, targeting prevention is a key part of the administration's global AIDS strategy, one that it says developing countries will need to buy into if they ever want to get the epidemic and its cost under control. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.